President Obama's second inauguration is less than a week away. What are the expectations for the event and for the president's second term? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. One of our regular analysts, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, is in D.C. with some of her students for the inauguration. We'll get their view of the upcoming event. We'll also talk about expectations for Obama's second term with two of our other regular analysts, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Also, the debt limit standoff and unveiling the White House's gun violence proposals and the Iowa legislature back in session. Politics Day starts right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday here on the program, a favorite of our week for many of us, including myself. Joining us today as our political analysts, we have Wayne Moyer, the Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, joining us by phone. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Great to have you with us, along with Chris Larimer, who is in our Cedar Falls studio. Chris is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Chris, hi.
Hi, Ben.
And we have a special guest. Wayne and Chris are with us for the entire hour. For the first half hour, we want to join up with one of our regular political analysts who, at the moment, is in Washington, D.C. in the run-up to the inauguration. We'll be there also during the inauguration. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Politics at Drake University from Washington, D.C. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I am fine, and I understand you're in a room there in Washington. Where exactly?
We're located at the Washington Center. They have a residential facility here. Mm-hmm. We've been here for 6 days, and we have another 6 days to go.
Okay, very good. Yes, you have a couple of guests for us. Tell us who's with you there.
Well, I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Catherine Fritke. I'm a radio broadcast student at Drake University with a minor in history and a concentration in politics.
Catherine, welcome to our program. Who else is in that room?
Hi, I am Drew Kaufman, and I am a junior politics and history major at Drake also.
Okay, very good. Rachel Caulfield, this is an ideal exercise to take political science out of the classroom in Drake University to go to the inauguration. What aspects are you most looking forward to or find most interesting for students of political science?
I think, you know, initially and most obviously, the chance to attend a presidential inauguration. This is a kind of once in a lifetime, well, or more, but for most people, it's going to be a once in a lifetime situation to be able to actually be in D.C., to see the run up to the inauguration and all the preparations that go on across the city, and then to stand on the Mall and actually witness that ceremony. It's, you know, it's a piece of American history, and to be able to witness it is pretty special. Mm-hmm. But then over the course of these 12 days, our students are doing an amazing amount in Washington, D.C. So we've had a lot of great opportunities, particularly through our alumni network here in Washington. They've been very good about setting up site visits and appointments for the students. They're personally meeting with the students and talking to them about what they do in Washington, and they've just been really amazing. So we're keeping the students very busy. They have academic sessions every morning. And then in the afternoons, we travel around the city, and they can tell you a little bit about some of the amazing things that they've done so far.
Okay, let's talk to, is it Catherine or Drew? Tell us, what has impressed you so far about the Capitol as it prepares for the inauguration?
Well, I was luckily a part of a small group that was able to go visit the West Wing from the help of one of our alumni, Zach Nunn, at the White House. And that was probably the moment that stuck out the most in my mind, just because not that many people get to go visit the West Wing other than when they're watching the actual television show or they see pictures from the Oval Office or the Rose Garden. Mm-hmm. And so actually being there in person and seeing everything and just kind of its state of glory was kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. Was it as you imagined it or not?
You know what? I walked in and I realized that it's much smaller than I kind of played it up to be in my mind. But then I remembered all the amazing things that have happened in that office, from the Situation Rooms to the Oval Office, and just all the things and the people that have been through those halls. And it just kind of expanded to be 200 times larger than I expected it to be.
Nice. Did you happen to run into the president or the first lady? I imagine that didn't happen, or did it?
Sadly, no, but the CIA director nominee walked by us, and he just had his name tag on, and he was wearing jeans and a white polo shirt, and if I hadn't have read his name tag really quickly, I just wouldn't have known.
Okay, so it seemed like business as usual there.
It was. For a Sunday afternoon when we went, there were still people working and keeping the country on track.
Okay. Drew Kaufman, what has stood out in your visit to the nation's capital so far?
Well, Saturday we got some time to really kind of go explore the city on our own. So we spent some of that time going around the National Mall, and so we got to see them building a lot of the various temporary infrastructure needed for an inauguration. So that was neat to see all of that going together. And we also spent some time talking to some of the people that actually live here and have lives other than just being tourists in D.C. at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, what interested you most about those conversations?
Well, we actually found a lovely lady she was originally from the Midwest out in Nebraska, and she'd been in D.C. for 9 years, so she had a couple inaugurations under her belt. And so we asked her, because, you know, coming here as tourists, we think, you know, there are all of these people that come to the National Mall and then, you know, crowd into D.C., a city bigger than the Des Moines metro area forms on the National Mall to watch this happen. And we think, well, gosh, that's got to be really annoying for the people that live here.
Right.
And so we talked to this lady, and she's like, well, you know, people in D.C. are used to crowds and whatnot. So we're just kind of planning on, like, you know, maybe making some changes in our everyday life, avoiding the metro transit and things like that. But I don't think it'll really faze many of them. So I thought, you know, somebody coming from the outside, that was interesting to hear that, you know, most people plan on going on with their lives. And, yeah, there's an inauguration happening, but that's not going to stop them from doing what they do.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, Drew, and Catherine, I want to turn to Wayne Moyer and Chris Larimer and invite you, Wayne and Chris, to as political scientists, what would you be keen on experiencing during the inauguration? Wayne?
Well, one question that comes to my mind is the Obama administration is allowing unlimited contributions from companies and individuals in terms of sponsoring the inauguration. And one always wonders what kind of influence they're likely to get as a result of this. And what I'm wondering is whether you see any visible signs in terms of advertisements, et cetera, from these big contributors.
Rachel, what about that?
I haven't seen anything yet. I know I was here for the 2009 inauguration, and I recall very clearly that there were certain sections of the city that had seemed to be entirely devoted to one advertiser or one organization. So, for example, when you went through Metro Center Metro Station in downtown Washington, D.C., Pepsi clearly got that space. Every sign that you saw, as far as your eye could see, was a Pepsi sign. So we haven't seen any of that yet. I expect that a lot of that will start to happen over the weekend as more tourists start to come into town and final preparations are made.
Yeah, we're still five or so days away from the inauguration. Any signs of gearing up for the big event yet, this far out?
Yeah, absolutely. Just as you walk around on the sidewalks, once you get close to the presidential parade route, they've already built up the presidential viewing stand. They have a lot of bleachers nearby. They also, on a lot of the side streets for where they close off for security, they've started moving in the concrete barriers that they'll move into the roadways to keep cars and stuff from getting anywhere close to the parade routes. So there's a lot of hustle and bustle as you get close to the National Mall and the White House.
Mm-hmm. And on the mall in general, there's just so much construction happening. You really can't enjoy the mall in its state when you would go sometime other than an inauguration, where you can see straight from side to side. So clearly there's a lot of work going into this inauguration already.
Chris Larimer, did you have a question or something to share and curiosity there?
Sure. Hi, Rachel. Hi, Catherine, Drew. Rachel, what you're doing, I think that's great what you're doing out there with them. I guess my question is, you know, if we think back to the inauguration in 2009, there was so much excitement not only surrounding the inauguration, but what the expectations were for the next 4 years. And now we've been reading, you know, in poll after poll that the expectations are extremely low, that people do not have any confidence in the direction of the country. Do you get that sense when you are out there in D.C. right now in terms of talking to people who are maybe visiting Washington, D.C. or who work there regularly, that there is a significant change in the mood?
Well, I think so. I would say just anecdotally, you know, all the expectations are that the crowd this year will be about a million fewer than it was in 2009. They're expecting about 800,000 people this year, so it's going to be a much smaller day on the Mall, which I have to tell you, that's okay with me, having experienced it in 2009. But, you know, anecdotally, when you speak to people that you know around Washington, I met up with a friend a couple days ago and talked to her about it. She said, you know, I was so excited to go down to the Mall in 2009, and this year, I'm thinking I'm going to curl up on the couch, have a glass of wine, and watch it. So I think there's a general, you know, I wouldn't say that people are not, you know, not paying attention or that they don't care. I think there's just a more somber attitude towards it. This is, you know, it's a presidency. It's not a, it's not a panacea.
Right. Next Monday, Inauguration Day, it's not only the Inauguration Day, but also a national holiday, a Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I wonder if you, Rachel, see that this changes the flavor of this inauguration, especially, of course, because we have our first black president.
Well, we do, and I think the most notable, most notable public recognition of that is Saturday's National Day of Service. And all across the city of Washington and all across the country, people are signing up for, signing up to participate in those National Day of Service events. This group of students will go to the citywide food bank and volunteer on Saturday morning in honor of Dr. King, and they're going to give back to the city of Washington after Washington is giving them a lot.
Yeah. Aside from the, where do you plan to be during the actual inauguration, those 3-4 hours and the inauguration speech?
Well, many of us were fortunate enough to write to our congressmen and senators and ask for inauguration tickets. And as of what I know, we all have tickets for the inauguration. And while we don't know what color tickets or where exactly we'll be within the ticketed areas, all of us have. But we're all very excited to be fortunate enough to be given the opportunity to be a little bit closer to the Capitol rather than when I was here in 2009. I was always all the way back at the Lincoln Memorial. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a very different experience for me. But I know that we're all lucky enough to have a ticket to be close to the Capitol and actually kind of witness something a little bit closer.
Aside from the actual day, you say you'll be there another 6 days, I think you said at the beginning, aside from Inauguration Day and the events that take place there, are you attending any other inauguration-related events? Any of the balls, for instance?
This is not inauguration-related, but we did have a good time last night. Drew will tell you real quickly.
Well, last night we were fortunate enough to go to the Truman Bowling Alley in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. It's a two-lane bowling alley, and it was originally built for when the Trumans were in office, they were avid bowlers, so they needed somewhere to hone their skills. So we got to spend about an hour and a half in the Truman Bowling Alley, and definitely it was quite the experience to bowl where presidents have bowled.
Yes, they had a great time.
I hope the lanes aren't warped.
Oh my gosh, they are.
All right. Well, there's another. That's not the only fix that's needed in Washington. I think many people will see.
Found another.
Rachel.
So over the next several days, we will be tomorrow. We will be at the U.S. Supreme Court. for much of our afternoon. And on Friday, we will be at the U.S. Capitol. We'll do a Capitol tour and meet with a number of people in Senator Harkin's office and Senator Grassley's office. And then we also have some great alums who are going to be meeting with us who serve with U.S. representatives from Iowa. My favorite piece before an inauguration, I've been to several inaugurations now, and I feel very strongly that a day or two before the inauguration, you really need to go to the National Archives and just appreciate that original Constitution and Declaration of Independence and soak it in a little bit. So we're going to do that on Saturday afternoon as a preparation.
Rachel Caulfield, you said you attended the inauguration in 2009. I don't know how many others you've been to, but can you share a moment from a past inauguration that stands out in your mind?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think the most memorable, I have a number of memories of presidential inaugurations. I was present in 2000 for the Bush inauguration when there were protests up and down Pennsylvania Avenue. It was a fascinating experience to see people come out and protest at an inauguration.
During the disputed election that had to be decided by our Supreme Court.
Exactly. And there were a lot of people who were very upset about the outcome, and they weren't afraid to voice their opinion. And I remember having two distinct thoughts, one of which was, you know, how remarkable that on the day that we're inaugurating our president, the entire, you know, value system of the United States is protecting this group of people's free speech rights to stand on the parade route and protest on a day of national celebration. I thought that was really remarkable. And then in 2009, to say I was here on Inauguration Day, I didn't actually witness the inauguration. I was one of the unfortunate souls who had a purple ticket. And so I spent the day under the mall in a highway tunnel. By the time I got to the purple ticket gate, it had shut down. And so I actually didn't get to witness the inauguration at all. But I will say, in retrospect, I was very disappointed on the day of, but in retrospect, I think it's a really unique experience that I had. I sat on a traffic barrier with two older women from Chicago who had worked on the campaign and who were just incredibly disappointed and were openly weeping about this day. And so I feel like I have kind of an alternative history in my head of what happened that day amid all the photos of all the crowds and the celebration and what have you. I have this totally different vision, and it's a great memory.
Rachel Caulfield is Associate Professor of Politics at Drake University, joining us live from Washington, D.C., there with a couple of her students from Drake, Drew Kaufman, and I believe Catherine Frichte, your last name. I apologize if I didn't get that quite correctly. I don't know if I heard it right. Catherine?
Yes, Catherine Frichte.
Frichte. Thank you very much for joining us. Enjoy your stay. Enjoy the inauguration, and thank you for sharing a little bit of your pre-inauguration experience with us.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
And this is Politics Wednesday here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, still with us, and we want to talk about some of the other happenings on the political landscape in the remainder of the hour. We heard at the top of the hour unveiling of sweeping new policies aimed at limiting gun violence. We want to talk about that, but we also want to talk about the debt ceiling standoff. And then also toward the end of the hour, Iowa politics. The governor gave his condition of the state speech yesterday. Maybe you tuned in for that and have some views on it. But before our break, let's get started a little bit with the president unveiling within the last few minutes, Chris and Wayne, sweeping new policies aimed at limiting gun violence. And this sets up a political showdown that it seems pits some public support for many gun control measures against Congress with not at least based on past procedures, not the biggest appetite for approving more stringent restrictions on gun ownership. What are you looking forward to here as we view the proposals coming out of the White House? Wayne.
Well, I think the thing that's most interesting to me is that Obama has moved so quickly. on this as he has. And I think that's, if he wants action, that's wise, while the public is still very concerned about what happened in Connecticut and the other shootings. The longer he had waited, unless there was another gun attack, the more the public would have lost interest, I think. So I think if he's to get any action at all, he had to move quickly. He has moved quickly. I'll be particularly interested in whether he can get the background checks made more complete so that everybody who has to buy or who is trying to buy weapons has to go through, or firearms has to go through, a background check. It seems to me that's more likely than the assault weapons ban, which I suspect is going to run into more trouble. I'm interested in all the executive actions in terms of enforcing the law and research on gun violence, et cetera. And I'll be very interested in what the congressional reactions to those things are. Well,
Wayne Moyer, explain that a little bit to us, because the administration is supplementing its proposal, and you named two of the four main ones, requiring criminal background checks on all gun sales, including private sales, banning military-style assault weapons, limiting ammunition magazines to 10 rounds, and strengthening penalties for gun trafficking. But because these recommendations require congressional approval, the administration is supplementing those and other proposals with 23 executive actions. What gives him the legal or constitutional right to take some actions without going through Congress?
Well, a lot of this is enforcement of existing laws. And how much emphasis the executive actually places on the enforcement of laws. And the executive has responsibility for the enforcement of law. And some of these laws have been indifferently enforced, or not enough money has been allocated for the enforcement of them. And Obama, in terms of his budget, in terms of his priorities, in terms of people he appoints, et cetera, can make a very significant difference in the extent to which these laws are enforced.
Chris Larimer, let me turn to you. We have about a minute before we go to break here. Give us your view on the upcoming showdown over these gun control policies.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what interests me is how quickly and what gets done, particularly as it relates to Congress. You know, I think if the president is able to push this through, as Wayne said, relatively quickly, and now it's into the hands of Congress, if nothing gets done, or if very little is done, and we see a lot of bickering and we see the process delayed and drawn out, I think, you know, this may be the last straw for the public when it comes to Congress. We know their approval ratings are in the tank. You know, very low approval ratings. But if, you know, there's so much frustration right now with government and the governing process, I think at some point Congress is going to have to move quickly on something. And so what I'm going to be watching is how quickly Congress moves and if they get enough done in the eyes of the public.
Okay, we're going to take a short break and come back, talk more politics on this Politics Wednesday. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College with us. We hope you'll join our conversation. Come back, we'll talk more about the gun policies, the proposals being introduced by the White House after this gun violence task force met. What do you think needs to happen to reduce gun violence? Has your view changed since the tragedy in Sandy Brook? And do you think there's the political will in Congress to do something? What do you think would be effective? We'll be back with more as we discuss the politics of this past week, including state politics, when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Call in 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back in just a few minutes. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Here in Iowa, we live in one of the top food producers in the nation, yet some of us Iowans still have trouble accessing healthy foods. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk with experts across the state about people who live in areas with low access to healthy food. They're areas often referred to as food deserts. We'll find out why people in these areas have trouble accessing healthy food and what efforts are being done to help these fellow Iowans tomorrow on this program. Today, Politics Wednesday. So glad to have with us Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our political analysts, this week. And continuing our discussion, President Barack Obama, within the last couple of hours, unveiling sweeping new policies aimed at limiting gun violence. Most of the effort, this is the most, can be classified as the most sweeping effort at gun control policy in a generation. The proposal comes at the end of a month-long review process spearheaded by Vice President Joe Biden. Four key subsections, a lot of proposals, four key subsections concerning law enforcement, the availability of dangerous firearms and ammunition, school safety and mental health, and some of the legislative proposals backed by President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden include requiring criminal background checks on all gun sales, including private sales, banning military-style assault weapons, limiting ammunition magazines to 10 rounds, strengthening penalties for gun trafficking. And because these recommendations require congressional approval, the administration is supplementing its proposal with 23 executive actions that will be taken immediately. We want to find out what you think of these proposals. What do you think needs to be done? Has your view on gun policy in this country changed since Sandy Hook and the preceding gun massacres that have been taking place regularly over the past few years in this country? 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Wayne and Chris, let's go right to the phones. Stanley is joining us from Fayette. Hi, Stanley. What's your view on this?
Well, hi. I have 2 points. I'm retired Army, and I feel if somebody has the permit to carry, they ought to be able to carry that in another state, not just to protect themselves, but protect others. And the second point is I think that they should allow our law enforcement to go back to profiling people. If you know a guy's a gang member, you know, and you see him on the street, you should be able to go up and allow to search him if he's known to possess weapons in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think they should give our police officers a little more leniency. And with the permit to carry, a police officer is able to take his weapon into another state. I don't understand why a citizen that has a permit to carry can't do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Have your, Stanley, have your views evolved over the last few days, a few weeks since Sandy Hook in particular?
Well, no, I've always felt that way, you know, if somebody's suspicious. I spent 16 years in Europe, and police officers over there, they don't have no qualms about stopping somebody and searching them if they suspect them of something, and they just don't have to have a reason to stop them either.
Okay, Stanley, thank you for your view from Fayette. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Your thoughts on the policies being proposed, the sweeping new gun policies proposed by the White House that have come out today, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Just yesterday, the National Rifle Association coming out. Of course, it's fighting back against this move. Here's a 30-second ad, the audio from it, that has just been put out by the National Rifle Association.
Are the president's kids more important than yours? Then why is he skeptical about putting armed security in our schools when his kids are protected by armed guards at their school? Mr. Obama demands the wealthy pay their fair share of taxes, but he's just another elitist hypocrite when it comes to a fair share of security, protection for their kids, and gun-free zones for ours.
That ad put out by the NRA just yesterday. So I wonder, Chris Larimer, do you see this ad, that argument, an elitist hypocrite tact there having traction among publics?
Well, I'm not sure it will. I think what they're trying to do there is simply tie, you know, what the Obama administration is trying to do in terms of banning particular types of weapons with a liberal agenda. I mean, if you look, you know, there's a recent poll out by the Pew Research Center and talking about these different gun policy proposals. And the ones that have the least support, or where you see that support right at kind of that 50-50 margin, are all the ones that deal with banning particular types of products, whether it's assault weapons or assault-style weapons, semi-automatic weapons. So I think what they're trying to do is tie what the Obama administration is in terms of being a Democratic administration with any sort of aggressive movement that is targeted at taking away particular products. So, it's going to harden Republicans, or because a lot of this breaks down on partisan lines. They're going to be kind of holding fast on their views. It may sway a few independents, but it's not going to do anything to folks who are independent or leaning Democrat.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the new Pew survey that's out. Interestingly, the issue of gun control, of course, remaining divisive. But clear agreement when it comes to a number of the gun policy proposals. Right. In that poll, fully 85% of Americans favor making private gun sales and gun sales at gun shows subject to background checks. And interestingly, comparable support from Republicans, Democrats, and independents on that. Another one where we see people coming together as far as the poll is concerned, 80% supporting laws to prevent mentally ill people from purchasing guns. Broad support across party lines on that question as well. Wayne Moyer, even if a majority of people favor some reform on some aspects, do you believe that the Congress has the ability to pass something here that will be effective?
If the support can be sustained, I think that it does. I think the Republican Party is likely to be very split on this. I think in urban areas, areas which are there are still competitive districts, areas that Obama won in elections, the Republican congressmen who come from those areas will, I think, feel themselves more endangered if they don't take action on gun control, while areas where which are more partisan Republican than areas that Obama lost in the election, I think will continue to be opposed to action. But I think this puts stresses on the Republican Party, okay, to some extent on the Democratic Party too.
And if I could, Ben, follow up on that. Mm-hmm. And I think the stress there is going to be for Republicans who are thinking about their primary election in 2014. We've seen a huge increase in the number of congressional seats across the country that are considered safe, where the other party really doesn't have any shot at it. Where incumbents get in trouble is in the primary election. And so if they start to move or be perceived as a bit soft on guns, they have to be thinking about that primary election down the road. And so I think that's where it's going to be interesting, is where if there are any incumbents in Congress who are see themselves as potentially vulnerable for a primary election in 2014.
Let's go back to the phones, get a few more views from River to River listeners before we move on politics day to a couple of other items on our agenda. Steve is with us from Ames. What do you have to point out, Steve?
Well, I have to point out a guy has to take a hunter safety course to be able to use a gun for hunting, and that's pretty much the only purpose of the course is for gun safety. Why is it that any guy can go out and buy him a gun without any prior safety training and treat it as a toy or treat it as a weapon, treat it as how they want to, whereas if you had a similar course for new gun owners, say once you get to the age you would like to buy a gun, you have to take a training course.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have certification to prove that you're able to handle this firearm, and that would have a way that the government could have somebody there, trainers, and they could see when somebody has mental problems, or they could see that they could look at the person's background before they're even able to get this permit just to be able to purchase guns.
Steve, are you a hunter, by the way?
Yeah, I hunt a lot.
And you would be in favor of the restrictions you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. There's no purpose in having an assault rifle for hunting. Okay. And, even though it's the new Bushmaster rifle, it is a real nice rifle. And it's useful for hunting. But when it comes to the point of 20-round clips, and, I'm all for restrictions when it comes to that. There's no purpose for 20-round clips for hunting. Nope.
Okay.
There's no animals going to stay around to get shot at 20 times, you know?
Steve and Ames, thank you very much for your opinion. Let's go to Ryan in Webster City. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I guess my concern, I have 2 points. One of them, my wife and I are both, we both carry, both have permits, and I favor a lot of people that do, but I also think that the permit to carry class is lacking a lot of it's got a lot of issues. You can take it online. You don't even need to handle a firearm before you can carry it in public. To me, I think there should be more restrictions, and I think you should have to qualify. You should have to prove that you're a competent human being to be able to carry a firearm in public, and you should be held at a little higher standard. And also the other point was, I do have an AR-15, a Bushmaster AR-15. I use it for coyote hunting and for target practice, and it actually is the perfect gun for coyote hunting. It's set up just for that. I have 30-round magazines, but we only fill them up to 10 just because it's too expensive and you don't need them, so that doesn't really bother me. But I'm more concerned with the removal of what they call an assault rifle, even though it's just a really cool-looking semi-automatic rifle. An assault rifle would be a full automatic, okay. Military style is, and I'm worried about that, I guess.
Ryan, thank you for airing your concerns from Webster City. This tells me, and the full line of phones tells me we'll have to get to more shows as this gun policy change develops in across the country. These proposals are evaluated and talked about. Right now, though, we want to move on to a couple of other items in our political news. Thank you very much for those calls. And callers who didn't get on, please stay tuned to River to River. In the coming days, we will be talking about gun policy in this country. Well, let's talk a little bit about the press conference President Obama held earlier this week, the coming debt ceiling standoff. And President here in that press conference warning about hitting that, not extending the debt ceiling. This from his press conference earlier this week.
If congressional Republicans refuse to pay America's bills on time, Social Security checks and veterans' benefits will be delayed. We might not be able to pay our troops or honor our contracts with small business owners, food inspectors, air traffic controllers, specialists who track down loose nuclear materials wouldn't get their paychecks. Investors around the world will ask if the United States of America is, in fact, a safe bet. Markets could go haywire. Interest rates would spike for anybody who borrows money. Every homeowner with a mortgage, every student with a college loan, every small business owner who wants to grow and hire. It would be a self-inflicted wound on the economy. It would slow down our growth, might tip us into recession, and ironically, would probably increase our deficit.
President Obama from earlier this week. Wayne Moyer, tell us, what positions are each side staking out?
Well, I think this is a big issue of credibility. Essentially, what Obama is saying is if you don't increase the debt limit without any kind of conditions, the country will go into default, and that will lead to a recession or enormous effects on business, et cetera. And to the extent that he's credible, then that would deter the Republicans from pushing it. On the Republican side, they're going to say, well, the only way that we're going to get real reductions in government spending is to threaten this. But there's a question there as to, this is a little bit like nuclear war and risking nuclear war. Are the consequences of default as serious or shutting the government as serious as Obama's says that they're going to be, or are they not so serious? The Republicans are kind of claiming they're not so serious. The Democrats are saying they're extremely serious.
Chris Larimer, fair to say, no real optimism among Republicans or Democrats that this standoff will end quickly or painlessly. I guess the strategy of each party rests largely on the other one folding their cards and admitting defeat. Is that the way you see it?
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, if you think back to the 2011 debt ceiling debate that took us essentially into default and we lowered the credit rating for a time being, you know, that was a case where Obama, for most reports, was perceived as not being very open to Republicans. It was finally at the last minute that he opened up and they made a deal and got us this the fiscal crisis that took us up to January 1st of this year. But in that case, he had to think about a reelection.
Okay.
In this case, there is no that re-election is gone. So the president is going to probably take this as far as he can. There are so many other issues in terms of the sequestration, that they still have to deal with in 2 months, deficits, how much they want to cut there. And there's a continuing resolution, which is currently funding the government, which runs out at the end of March. So, You know, I don't see a lot of budge on this on either side. My guess is that going forward, they may make some small concessions on raising the debt ceiling, but then you're going to probably see a continuing resolution that's going to take us through the end of this fiscal year. So you're going to have another year where they don't really pass a budget. They just pass continuing resolutions to get us to the next fiscal year.
And finally, today we wanted to talk a little bit about Iowa politics. Governor Branstad just yesterday laying out in a 33-minute condition of the state speech that Iowa is well-positioned for unprecedented growth, he said. Let's listen to one of the comments. He says the state is in such a healthy condition that we can focus on big improvements, namely permanent tax cuts for business property owners, incentives to lure doctors to live in Iowa, also better pay for new teachers. Here's what he had to say on that specific point.
I'm recommending a $160 million state investment in this new teacher compensation model to keep our best performing teachers in the classroom throughout their entire careers. And I believe that we should resolve the issue of what we're collectively willing to invest in achievement-driven reform before we spend a minute discussing additional resources to support our existing educational system.
I want to turn to our guests. Chris Larimer, first of all, what did you hear in the governor's condition of the state address? For instance, which of those proposals that he laid out do you think has a good chance of making it through our state house?
Well, I think the one that probably has the best chance is, you know, is some of his ideas on improving health for all of, improving health access essentially for citizens of Iowa. I think that maybe has the best chance to get through. And you might see some movement on teacher pay. You know, depending on whether you get the increase of $7,000 or not is a little bit of a question. But I think there were three things that stuck out to me as being potentially very contentious for this session. One was, you know, we all knew the 800-pound gorilla coming into the speech was the $800 million surplus. And the governor had one line on that saying that we should return the surplus to Iowa taxpayers. Now, that's going to be battled out between Democrats and Republicans. And, you know, who gets the tax cut, how much, that's going to be up for debate. The other one was this idea of doing away with allowable growth for K through 12 schools. There's going to be a lot of pushback by Democrats, a lot of pushback by, you know, educators in the state about how exactly you go about doing that because schools are already planning their budgets for the next year. And I guess the third thing was just this idea of the one combined rollback on property taxes where you have a rollback of 2% instead of at 4% where you're essentially cutting 2% of the property tax revenues that are coming in and relying on the state to then make up that gap for local governments. We've all heard that, you know, the state government doesn't always have the best record in terms of fulfilling its promises there. So I think those three areas you're going to see a lot of contention going forward in this legislative session.
Wayne Moyer, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something on the health issue. I guess there's a question in my mind as to how much you can improve the health of citizens in Iowa as long as you have a substantial number of people who don't have health insurance. And Governor Branstad, it seems to me, is rejecting the increase in the numbers of people on Medicaid, essentially under the Obamacare law. And so it seems to me there's a bit of an inconsistency of not expanding Medicaid at the same time as you're trying to improve the quality of people's health.
Daniel is joining us on the line from Woodward. Daniel, governor saying we're in pretty good shape fiscally, especially when you compare us to some other states. What is your view on the condition of our state?
Well, a lot of services were cut back and actually taken away. We closed state parks. People who regulate and inspect areas such as agriculture, inspectors and enforcement people were cut back. So we have lost some environmental and quality of life issues. Let's open some state parks. Let's restore the park staff. I want my DNR park rangers back. I want the wildlife biologists back. Don't do this on the cheap. So my question is to your guest, how can we as citizens convince the governor that money invested in the ecological infrastructure of the state of Iowa is absolutely critical, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you. I got your name wrong. Forgive me. It's Danielle from Woodward. And quickly, we have just about a minute left. Wayne, Chris, you want to tackle Danielle's query?
Well, I think you've got to get the legislature to work on it and mobilize groups of people and start getting state senators and representatives actually working on this.
So the same is true as pretty much any issue. Get in touch with your congressman or congresswoman and apply some pressure. Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if you look at the governor's budget, it's going to be tough. I mean, a lot of the big increases are in the areas of economic development. So the areas that Danielle was talking about, that's going to take the, you know, some serious attention by her state legislators and putting pressure in the governor's office.
Okay. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Wayne, Chris, as always, a delight to have you and hear your insights. Thank you both.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Tomorrow on this program, we are going to talk about something called food deserts. No, I didn't say desserts. I said the one S word, food deserts. These are places in Iowa where people have low access to healthy food. We'll find out why people in these areas have trouble accessing healthy food, what efforts are being done to help these residents. Perhaps you live in one of these areas and you want to tune in. Join our conversation tomorrow. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan in Ames. Help from Alyssa Weiss in Cedar Falls. Tony Daner. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.